moving line.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. This is February 13th, 2009. Colleagues, today we're talking about a framework for discussion on the corporate minimum tax. I would like to welcome Senator Burdick and Senator Morris to sit in with us this morning. We appreciate your being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Paul?
Morning, Mr. Chair. Happy Friday the 13th.
I didn't even realize that.
We have...
I take it you're a trichodecophile.
I couldn't remember that term, Mr. Chair, but I knew Mazin knew it, and I didn't have a chance ask him to remind me.
I've sat next to him too often.
Yes. Members of the committee, what we want to do this morning with you is provide some background material leading into a discussion of a major issue on your work plan, which is corporate minimum tax reform. So our goal this morning is to go through some context-type material for you to kind of set the stage for that discussion. You have a couple of bills in committee, one from the governor, one from the Interim Revenue Committee, and then we suspect there will be some other versions as well for you to look at on this issue of corporate minimum tax reform. But what we wanted to do is step completely back and spend a little bit of time looking at the business taxes in general. Chris is going to go through our current corporate income tax base and answer any questions that you have around apportionment and other issues that determine our current base and show you kind of a composition of the filers who are paying the minimum tax and who they are and who we think they are. So to give you some background there. And then I was going to talk a little bit about some of the alternative tax bases. This is an area where we've seen a lot of movement on the part of states in recent years. They've really been looking at some different approaches to business taxation. We'll talk a bit about those and show you some of those results. And then finish with a discussion of a criteria for evaluation. What kind of things would we use if we're looking at some alternative revenue structures? And this has really grown out of the work of the Revenue Restructuring Task Force this past interim. When Chris and I are through, we have asked a panel to come talk to you about some of the advantages and disadvantages of some of the options out there. And that panel, we drew heavily on our advisory council from the Revenue Restructuring Task Force. We've asked John Taponia from Echo Northwest is here. Milo Ormseth, who was also on the advisory council from formerly of Stoll Reeves, will be here. And Doug Henney is a CPA and on our Revenue Advisory Council for the revenue forecast is here. So the three of them will come up and give you some of their thoughts on those issues and address questions and discuss some of the issues with you. So what we have to work through with you is a packet. It's corporate minimum tax reform, and I borrowed heavily on a report that I think is a good one. We could debate about some of the results, but I like some of the way things are laid out and structured because I think it gives you a framework to think about some of the issues around business taxation. The timing was very good. Their updated report, this is from the Council on State Taxation, came out yesterday. So this is their latest report, so it's the latest numbers that you'll see. The council is a business-supported organization by chambers of commerce around the country, but the work that's done on this is done by Ernst & Young, and I think it's pretty good work. Bob Klein, who leads this project, is a former Michigan and Minnesota Revenue Department official, so he's very familiar with it, with the state side of things as well. First thing, page I have there is an executive summary that kind of lays out just to give you some introduction to what the study does. But I wanted to draw your attention to the next page, which is total state and local business taxes in 2008. And again here, the purpose of this is to really give you some broad context about what we're looking at when we look at taxes that are paid by businesses. One thing to keep in mind when we look at business taxes, what we're looking at is what we call the initial incidence. We're looking at who actually writes the check and to the state or local government for that tax. Now, there is another step that we can go beyond that with our Oregon tax incidence model that addresses the deeper question of who ultimately bears the burden of the tax. So, for example, we may have a tax, a gross receipts tax, for example, on business, but that gross receipts tax may end up raising consumer prices, and it's really consumers who ultimately bear the burden of that tax. So our discussion really today is the first step, which is this initial incidence in terms of business taxation. And that's what we have laid out for you here in this total state and local business taxes in FY 2008. A couple things that stand out. Number one is the most important tax that business paid, or the largest, is business tax or property taxes on commercial and industrial property. That's about a third of their total tax burden nationally. So the property tax is the biggest tax that's typically paid by business. This is also the area where you get in debates whether the property tax is regressive or progressive, because it depends on the assumptions about whether that shows up in higher prices or reduces returns to capital, but that's another issue. So property taxes are 35%. The second is those of us that don't live in a sales tax state sometimes forget that a retail sales tax typically is paid roughly 25% on business-to-business purchases. So it's businesses that are paying that retail sales taxes on goods or sometimes services that they buy from other businesses. So that's where that 22% comes from. It's a sales tax, but it's really a tax that business pays on purchasing the inputs that they use for their production or their service. Now, our discussion, of course, will center around the corporate income tax, because the corporate minimum is a portion of that. And you can see the corporate income tax is only about 10%. And that will bounce around with economic conditions. Notice their one-year growth is already down 7%, as you can start to see the impact of the recession on the corporate income tax, which is the most volatile of these taxes that you see. So as you go down that list, then you can see the other components, license fees, utility taxes, excise taxes. The other one I'd call your attention to is the individual income tax on business income. That's at 4.6%, which is primarily through the pass-throughs. So there's an estimate in the Ernst & Young study that looks at how much of the business tax is paid by, filters through the individual income tax.
Mr. Chair, who's got the gavel?
Representative Berger.
Thank you. If you'll indulge me just a minute, a couple of questions on this. Individual income tax on business income, is that like S-corp pass-through?
Representative Berger, yes. What they don't include here, or at least from what we can tell, we don't think they include the partnership income that would be paid through a Schedule C. So this is primarily pass-through income through S-corporations.
Further question. In this, and I know you didn't come up with these divisions, but where in here would you find, or would you find, things like the metro and lane payroll tax?
Representative Berger, the payroll tax shows up as an income tax on business income.
Okay.
And that's how it shows up in the census data.
Okay.
So that gives you an overall perspective. Now, the next page looks at all the states. So you can see how the states look in terms of their comparison about that proportion of the tax that is paid by business. And they look at it in terms of the share of total state taxes, share of total local taxes. And then the last column, to me anyway, the most interesting is the percent of gross state product. So if you look at the first grouping there, you can see on state taxes, the average business share is about 40%, 39.7. For Washington ranks relatively high at 53%. But when you think about it and think about Washington's taxes, B&O tax is a large portion there, and also retail sales. As we've shown, retail sales have a higher percentage initial business incidence than does the personal income tax. So Washington ranks relatively high. Oregon, on the other hand, ranks near the bottom with about 30.4% as the business share. Now, clearly a portion of that, or probably a very big portion of that, is the income tax-dominated system we have. Because if you compare, if you were to take a dollar-for-dollar trade, of a, eliminate the income tax and replace it with a sales tax, you've got the income tax, which is 5 to 10% business foreign. The sales tax is about 25%. So that kind of shift would automatically lead to a shift in the initial incidence on business. Now, if you look at the local portion...
Paul, this is an annual rate?
This is the business share. It's based on the 2007-2008 fiscal year.
Great, thank you.
So they use a lot of census data, but they also try to augment that. Now, if you look at the local share of business share, nationally it's 50.7, Oregon is 50%, so right about at the average. So really the difference there is on the state side with it, through the lack of a sales tax and the personal income tax. Now, if you look at percent of gross state product on average, which would give you, again, this is all as an initial incidence, state and local taxes are just a short of 5%. The total state and local tax burden nationally averages about 10.5%. So we're about 10%. So 4.9% for the U.S. Again, Washington is above overall at 5.5%. California is a little below at 4.6. One thing I should point out, an anomaly in this approach, and it's just an inherent a problem that comes up with this type of approach, is you look at the highest percentages. They are in those states that are resource producers, and they tend to be what we call export taxes. They export usually resources, but they export the taxes along with them. In other words, they're picked up in the price that consumers pay. So Alaska, for example, has a very high ratio. Well, it's really not Alaska businesses that are paying that. They may be writing the check, but they're shifting on most of those taxes to consumers, some of whom live in Oregon, of that oil and gas.
And very few of whom live in Alaska.
Yes, correct. So they're exporting it, in other words. The other high number is Wyoming, so a similar kind of result there. So keep that in mind when you look at some of the high ones. Oregon ranks right at the bottom with at 3.7%. Connecticut's 3.7, Delaware's 3.8. 3.6 is the lowest there at North Carolina. So if you look at just this initial incidence, Oregon's share, business share, is right near the bottom among the percentages, and a lot of that gets back to the tax structure tied back to the not having a sales tax and being so dependent on the personal income tax. So if there, what I'd like to do is turn over to Chris to walk through some of our current corporate tax base issues and address any questions you have there, and talk about the information we have on those that are paying the corporate minimum tax. Then I'll come back and talk a little bit about some of the alternative approaches that states have been using that could be considered.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. I have a few pages here to make sure we're all on the same page about some of the context for the corporate income tax. And some of this information will be familiar to returning members, but hopefully it'll provide a little bit of insight so that everybody's on the same page. As you recall from the orientation, the starting point for Oregon corporate tax is federal taxable income. And for companies that operate solely in Oregon, that's their total tax base, the federal taxable income. For those corporations that operate in multiple states, there's the issue of apportionment and how much of that federal taxable income is taxed by Oregon. So that first page there, the Oregon's apportionment formula, just shows a bit of history of the apportionment formula. And prior to 1990, Oregon used an equally weighted three-factor formula with sales, payroll, and property. And then from 1991, we changed to a double-weighted sales factor, so sales counted for 50% of the apportionment formula, and then payroll and property each 25%. And then from 2003 to 2005, we went to a super sales factor formula where sales account for 80%. And then since July 1, 2005, we're at a 100% sales factor formula. A couple of things about the apportionment formula. 22% of all corporations are affected by the apportionment, and that's both C and S corporations for tax year 2006. And so in terms of numbers of corporations, that's about 12,000 C corporations and just under 7,000 S corporations. Currently on the books, there are two exceptions to the single sales factor. The utilities and telecoms are allowed to use a double-weighted formula. And then certain wood products corporations must use a double-weighted sales factor, although that last one, we don't think there are any existing companies that are able to take advantage of that piece.
Mr. Chair, the committee has introduced a bill to eliminate that one as well.
Okay. Turning to the next page, just a couple of examples of how the apportioning works. So on this one, the multi-state corporation A operates in Oregon and California and has the payroll, property, and sales indicated there on the page. So Oregon, $12 million of payroll, $20 million in property, and $20 million in sales. And in California, 28 in payroll, 30 property, and 60 sales. So the percent factors are, for Oregon, 30% payroll and 70% in California for all of their payroll. And then their property, 100% of their property, 40% is in Oregon, 60% in California. And then sales, it's 25% in Oregon and 75% in California. So this corporation only operates in those two states, and you can see how those three factors are divided between those two states. The apportionment factor for each of the states, for Oregon, it would be 25%. That's their sales factor. And then for California, which uses a double-weighted sales factor, would be 70%. So for this hypothetical corporation with net income of $5 million, the amount that's taxed by Oregon is the $5 million times the 25%, or $1.25 million. And then for California, it's the $5 million times the 70%, or $3.5 million, is taxed by California. So the total there is $4.75 million in taxation, and that highlights one of the aspects of the problem with the varying states using different apportionment formulas. You can have either more or less than 100% of that income being taxed across the states. The next page shows the hypothetical impact of changing from a double-weighted sales factor to a single sales factor. So here we have two companies, Company A and Company B, that have identical payroll and property sales factors, 30% and 40%, respectively. Company A, however, has a 20% sales factor, and Company B has a 50% sales factor. So under the double-weighted system, Company A would have an apportionment percentage of 27.5%, and then Company B would be 42.5%. The move to the 100% sales factor changes those apportionment percentages. For Company A, it reduces it from 27% to 20%. And then for Company B, it increases it from 42% to 50%. And so the boxes below that table show for Company A, again, an example of a $5 million net income, under the double sales, they had to pay tax on $1.375 million of income. And under the single sales, that taxable income got reduced to $1 million. Again, just because of the sales factor got reduced. But for Company B, another $5 million company, under double sales, they had taxable income of just over $2.1 million, and then that was increased to $2.5 million. So the switch from the singles, from the double-weighted sales factor to the single sales, there are winners and losers in terms of the impact on individual corporations. Okay, turning to the next slide. And the next couple pages here are pertaining to tax year 2006, and they're just, again, some context on who is paying the tax and who's paying the minimum tax. This table, this chart right here, shows the top 10 largest industry sectors for 2006. The bars represent the number of tax returns, and then the line there shows the tax imposed, and that's over on the right hand, the magnitudes on the right hand side of that chart. So we can see the four largest sectors are wholesale trade, finance and insurance, retail trade, and manufacturing, all paid a net tax of $40 million up to $110 million, with wholesale trade being the largest sector. Most of the tax burden falls on the wholesale trade sector. And then when we get down to information, it somewhat levels off where the liability gets to be just under $20 million per sector. So we can see that a lot of the tax is concentrated in those four sectors for 2006. Now, these top 10 sectors account for about 65% of the corporations and about 91% of the tax. In the next chart, it's the number and tax liability in C corporations according to Oregon sales. So we can see here, again, it's the same kind of structure where the bars represent the number of tax returns. And we can see how for sales up to about $5 million, the number of tax returns is kind of in the 3,000 to 4,000 number per sales category. And then it really drops off. So the number of companies that have significantly large numbers of sales really falls off, so that when you get to companies with over $250 million of sales, you get down to I think it's about 40 companies. And then you can see by the line chart there the amount of tax paid by those groups. And as you might expect, it's fairly low for the companies with minimal sales or small amount of sales, and then jumps up really high as an amount of sales grow. And this is another way of just looking at the concentration of the corporate income tax. And you have a handful of companies paying the lion's share of the corporate tax. The last two pages pertain to the corporate minimum tax. And here we have the same top 10 sectors, the number of returns, and the percent in that sector that pay the minimum tax. Overall, about 63% of C corporations pay the minimum tax. And for these top 10 sectors, we can see that percentage, which is shown on the right-hand axis, is anywhere in the range of 50 to 70%. So it all centers around that kind of 60% rough average of even across sectors. And the number of returns there, a couple things that stand out there are the high number of construction returns and professional scientific returns paying the minimum tax.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Berger.
Can we just briefly say why they do or do not pay the minimum tax?
Sure. Representative Berger.
For the record. I think I know the answer to this question, but I'd like to put it on it because you didn't say that in here.
Okay. The reasons, about 75% of the corporations that pay the minimum tax have little or no income in that year. The other reasons, you have either little or no income in that year, you could have loss carryforwards from a prior year. And that is the lion's share of the reason the corporations are paying the minimum tax. That's about 75%. Another possibility is tax credits that get used. And I believe that's about 1% of the corporations that have their tax reduced to the minimum tax because of use of tax credits. And then the rest are kind of a combination. Either they have some income, but then they're also using some credits, so it's a combination of those factors.
Thank you, Chris.
And just to follow up on that, when you describe a company with no income, in many cases, what you mean is that after paying the principals of the business, there's no income.
Correct, Mr. Chair. We're talking about taxable income.
Right. I'm reminded of the reality that there are a lot of reasons to incorporate that don't imply that the funds are going to be held in the corporation. But, in fact, there may be times when, especially in the area of professional, scientific, and technical companies, there may very well be excellent business and tax reasons why their net income may be paid out as in payroll at the end of the business year rather than held in the company, and they're therefore subject to federal corporate tax as well as later on when the money is paid out to the shareholders, subject to their personal income taxes. So some of these companies actually make a great deal of money, but their business model doesn't include keeping any of it in the corporation. I think that's a fair statement, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah, what we're talking about here on the income is you kind of have the gross receipts and then all of the business expenses and then ultimately the taxable income, which is what the rates get applied
right.
to. So there, I think you're talking about all of the pieces in between the gross receipts and that taxable income.
Correct. And the business expenses include the wages paid to wages and salaries paid to the principals of the business.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that's actually our next chart.
Ah. Sorry.
You're ahead of us. Two charts up.
The last chart here pertaining to tax year 2006 is just at the minimum taxpayers rather than by industry. It is by sales category. And so this in part gets at to the point where for Oregon, the large share of companies paying the minimum tax have sales of less than $5 million, and you can see that by the bars indicating the number of corporations. And then there are just a handful of the companies that have significant Oregon sales that pay the minimum tax. And that the line there is, again, the percentage, and you can see how that declines. As the amount of sales goes up, the share of corporations in those sales categories paying the minimum tax falls from about 70% down to about 30%. And so that's just a little bit of context for what we see in the tax year 2006 C corporation returns.
Mr. Chair, the next chart is the one I was referring to just a very basic framework for you to kind of think about the different tax bases that are used by states, and I'll give you some examples of states that rely on these different bases. But I think a lot of the discussion around the corporate minimum alternatives really going back to the plan that was part of Measure 30 back in 2003, and then some proposals we've had the last couple of sessions have largely gone around Chris's data on sales, which is really gross receipts. And so what I've tried to do with this chart is color code those bases, and the gross receipts base would be just equal to the amount you sell times the price you sell it at. So it's just the total revenue coming into that corporation through its sales. And that is typically the top line you see on an income tax return. So gross receipts would be one, or sales would be one, a tax base in which to look at and say, okay, this is a reflection of what this company does, and therefore it should be serve as the base for taxes. The states that rely on gross receipts are Washington, of course, through the B&O tax, and Ohio through the commercial activity tax, are the two largest examples. Now, Ohio just in the last few years has eliminated their corporate income tax and gone to what they call a CAT, which is a commercial activity tax, and that's based on gross receipts. So that's one potential base to look at. It's the broadest base possible in terms of its economic impact. If you look at it on a very general level, like a broad gross receipts tax, very similar to a retail sales tax. It tends to be broader than a sales tax, and if we wanted to get into some discussion of this, we have a lot of data on Washington where you can compare Washington's B&O tax with their retail sales tax. B&O tax is a much broader base, includes manufacturers and other types of industries that are not real well represented in their retail sales base. So that's the broadest tax category to look at. Now, as Chris was talking about, the chair pointed out about getting down to net income, typically what you do on your form is you subtract out all your costs. Well, the biggest cost for most companies is the payments to labor. So wages and benefits would obviously be something that would be a cost of producing whatever product it is you're producing. And you think about the other productive inputs that are used in the production process, the second biggest is capital. So payments to capital become a cost of that production, and typically those are measured in terms of interest and dividends. And you would typically have some type of a rate of depreciation here. And of course, this is what we've, the discussion you've had around the depreciation schedules that the federal government is proposing to change. And that factors into those gross, as a cost that can be subtracted from gross receipts to get down to net income. The third is payments to natural resources there, and typically those are rents, and I put royalties just as a payment on natural resource usage. So if you think about, and the way economists thinks about things is, here's your total receipts from your product, here's your total inputs, and those are all in green on your color copies there. And that's the base that we refer to as value-added or activity-based. So those green components, payments to labor, payments to capital, payments to natural resources, are the value added by the company. I mean, that's what they're doing in their production process. The state that has, that uses that base, it doesn't actually use the natural resource, it uses payments to labor and payments to capital, is New Hampshire, through what they call their business enterprise tax or their BET. Michigan, through its single business tax, had this base as well. They have gone to a more traditional gross receipts tax in the last couple of years. So they're up in that red category now. The other main expenditure for businesses are the things that they buy from other businesses. So this is the auto manufacturer that buys parts from all its parts dealers. Those are not things they manufacture themselves. They buy it from their suppliers. And the payments to other businesses are part of gross receipts. So you take gross receipts and you subtract all the costs you've done in your production process and subtract out all the other things you bought from other businesses, and that's what gets you down to net income. So you can begin to see some of the issues around these bases and why we have some of the issues that come up. Chris mentioned, why do we have corporations that are paying the minimum? Well, obviously they're going to pay the minimum if the sum of these other categories, the green and the black, their value, the cost of their value they've added, and the cost of what they bought from other businesses, if that's more than their gross receipts, then they're going to pay the corporate minimum, because they're going to have zero or negative net income. So you can also see some of the issues around a gross receipts base. Let's say, for example, that you have gross receipts of $100 million, but you're some type of a wholesaler, for example, and your payments to other businesses are $95 million. And your the value you add is say $4 million, and you have $1 million net income. Well, that's a big difference between a company that would do that and another that might have, you know, $100 million in gross receipts but only purchase $10 million from other businesses. So you can see the difference that comes up in a gross receipts base versus some of these other bases. So, for example, the company that has high profits is going to pay more taxes through the net income. The company that has purchases a lot from other businesses is going to have a lot higher effective rate under a gross receipts tax than they would under a value-added or a net income base. So these choices of these bases are significant in terms of how they affect different industries and how they're structured and the kind of format that they have. So that gives you a sense of those three bases. And again, there's not, you know, if you look at these from a state standpoint, there's not an ideal base here. Each one of them has its advantages and disadvantages. I think our panel is going to talk some about that, but those are the kinds of things to start to weigh when you look at alternative bases. As I said, really, the proposals we've tended to see in the past for corporate minimum reform have tended to be kind of a very low level, but a gross receipts base, where you say, okay, if they have zero net income, they still should be paying more than $10. But how do we determine that? Well, if you look at gross receipts, that's one way to look at that, or to look at the amount of value that company adds. So those are two alternatives when you start to look at these tax base options. And then the next page I have after that is just some discussion, again, out of the Council State Taxation Study, the Ernst & Young study, that talks about, just briefly, about the shift we see going on among business, or among states, and the states that have really a gross receipts base, and now really it's Michigan, Ohio, and Michigan, Ohio, Texas, and Washington, and really New Hampshire is the only state that has a very clear value-added type base through its business enterprise tax. As I said earlier, Michigan used to have a value-added base. So the last thing I wanted to talk about before we turn it over to our panel is kind of some criteria to think about as you look at alternatives. And again, these are the kind of things that we typically look at, and we did spend a lot of time kind of trying to flesh these out during the Revenue Restructuring Task Force in the interim and really looking at some alternative proposals. But I think here is another use for this kind of criteria. The first issue is some measure of equity. And I think one of the things you'll find right away is you've got two basic approaches, and you get some real different answers depending on that approach you use. And you have the issue of whether some of the kinds the kind of approaches we use oftentimes to household are those most appropriate on the business side, and should there be a difference? And I'll talk about that in a minute. If you look at equity, one approach is ability to pay, and of course, net income tends to be most focus on that ability to pay. And the way we're currently structured now, through a corporate income tax, a net income tax with a flat rate. So what that's saying is if you don't have net income, you only pay the $10, which is kind of a token payment. So as that net income goes up, then the amount you pay would go up by 6.6% of that. Another approach that is used, and this is one that the Council of State Taxation has pointed to and done some work on that in the following pages, and that's to use the benefits approach to say, okay, the company or the business is producing something in this state or in this local community, and it's using public services to some extent to do that. And shouldn't that be the more appropriate measure of the equity? That shouldn't the tax burden match those benefits that are received? So that would lead to a lot different results. So here you would have a company that may be large, has zero net income for various reasons, its costs are high, but if it's large and uses a lot of public services, then that's saying its tax burden should reflect that service use and not just its net income. So you get some real different answers with those two approaches. The third equity issue is around horizontal equity, which says there should be whatever decision you make on the first two, there should be some consistency across industries. You shouldn't have a lot of variation in that burden. If you've chosen one of these approaches, then it should be consistent across those industries, and we're not distorting economic signals by favoring one industry over another. The other issue is impact on economic growth. I think there's two things here. One is we know that economic growth is dynamic and tends to be a lot of it comes from startups and small business, so that's an important issue. And the other is how the system treats those that are successful within the economy, and what kind of a deterrent might your tax system have with respect to rates of return on, especially on capital and business income in general. Another issue that, of course, is near and dear to our hearts here in the legislature, and that's revenue stability. As we mentioned, we've seen historically the corporate income tax has been extremely unstable because of its net income base. These other bases we looked at are considerably more stable, particularly the gross receipts base. I mean, that's one of its strengths. And finally, as the Department of Revenue will tell you, you know, you can come up with the best plan that everybody loves, but if they can't administer it, can't make sure there's compliance for a reasonable cost, then the plan is not worth a lot. So that's another issue that's important. I'll finish by just talking about it really more in the way of kind of introducing this concept rather than highlighting the results of the Ernst & Young study. But if you look at the next page, what they've called an alternative measure of business taxation, if you go down in the second paragraph, and I'll quote here about halfway through that paragraph. It says, in quotations, "What is the basis or rationale for business taxation at the state or local level? The basic rationale for business taxes, recognize that business taxes are ultimately borne by consumers or owners of factors of production, the final incidence, is to pay for government services that directly benefit business." So what they've done is try to lay out a framework. A lot of this work was done by William Testa, Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He's been arguing for decades that we should be looking at state corporate income tax from a benefit perspective and give us a sense of whether there's actually reflecting the cost of those services. And what Ernst & Young has done, and as they say, and I'll give you another quote in the second paragraph, is that the ratio of business taxes to government expenditures for services benefiting business is very sensitive to assumptions about who benefits from public spending, particularly who benefits from education. So keep in mind, if you look at this next table, what they've assumed, and I would argue somewhat arbitrarily, that 25% of education expenditures directly benefit business. So that's kind of a key assumption, but the point here is the kind of the framework that they use for looking at the these ratios. And so what they come up with is the tax burden exceeds services largely because of that assumption. But you can see how it varies across states. Oregon ranks very low in this ratio of services to taxes. Again, because of that low relative burden through the income tax-dominated system. So that ratio tends to reflect that. But the point, again, is this gives you kind of a framework to start to think about what might be an approach to look at business taxation rather than just say $10 is too low or too high and start to try to put some thought in terms of the overall fiscal system. And what might give you some direction. The last chart I have here just is, gives you some sense of, shows you how different industries are affected by the different taxes. And again, this can get at that horizontal equity issue. So, you know, you look at for example, something like a gross receipts tax, excise and gross receipts taxes. Well, those are going to be borne heavily by wholesale trade, by communications, by financial services, particularly wholesale trade, because as we mentioned earlier, wholesale trade is going to have high gross receipts but relatively low net income. And so that gives you some sense of how that may vary. You can see some of the service sectors pay a relatively high amount of the pass-through income. For example, financial services, real estate, and services in general, and business services all pay a relatively high proportion of that pass-through income. So, you know, just the choices that have been made now in our current business tax structure have a differential impact on industries because these different taxes affect how those industries are structured differently. So, Mr. Chair, I think that's all we have. I'm open for any questions before we turn it over to our panel.
Quick one, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Bruin.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Going back to this, I don't know if it's not a graph, the spreadsheet on page 7 that talks about the ratios between what businesses pay in taxation and the relative expenditures on the state level that support. And just a quick question. First of all, I think it's a great thing to look at. I hear what you're saying. So there's some arbitrary measures in this. Are one of those arbitrary measures when we're looking at the natural resource states? I'm looking at a state, once again, like Wyoming or Oklahoma or Alaska, but especially Wyoming, 4.21. That wouldn't be considered the worst state in the nation to do business in. It's because those taxes are truly being passed on to out-of-state customers.
Yes, Representative Bruin, I think that the same issue that was on that other chart about the share of taxes paid by business in those states being very high, yeah, the same issue filters through here. So I think that is very misleading for those states.
Is there any entity that has done a similar analysis of this that may have accommodated some of those variances that skew the results? I mean, I think this is a great potential tool if it's truly massaged down to be a good tool. I think this creates some distractions, though.
I would agree, Representative Bruna. You know, there's been work done in this trying to estimate the amount of tax exporting that's done. I haven't seen it, you know, taken to a point of looking at these comparisons. They've been more independent studies about, you know, what share is exported. But I think that could be, certainly these could be modified to capture that. The other thing I mentioned, too, I think this study does tend to underestimate the share of business paid for the personal income tax, which would be another modification that could be made to this study. But again, I think if we look out there now and this kind of comparison stuff, this is probably as good as we've got at this point. Hopefully they would begin to do that. It used to be they didn't even include the pass-throughs at all, and in the last few years they've been including the pass-through income. So they're starting to take care of some of those problems. And I know they're well aware of this particular issue. And, you know, another state this comes up with, I think, is Nevada, where Nevada shows a very low ratio, but a lot of that is kind of the reverse. They have what shows up as a consumer tax or household tax is really paid by tourists. So you get kind of the reverse happening there, artificially lowering their number.
Thank you very much. That's a great overview. I think we'll go ahead with our panel then.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Don Tapania, Milo Ormseth, Doug Henney, thank you, gentlemen, very much for being willing to come and share with the committee today. You've already volunteered a lot of your time to the state as we study these issues, and we appreciate your being willing to come back and talk to us again.
You're welcome.
Should I go ahead and...
Insert. Go ahead, you've got the mic.
Okay, all right. For the record, I'm John Tapania. I'm a managing director at Echo Northwest, a Portland-based economic consulting firm. In the interest of full disclosure, I do consult to the Oregon Business Plan, and I'm also the husband of a Portland school teacher and the parent of two Portland school kids, so I have sort of counterbalances there in terms of... thoughts about the budget.
We all have a variety of interests in
yes.
the state budget.
Okay. I thought I would just start with some sort of general observations about the context of this policy debate that you're in the middle of, and then step through, I think, five questions that this body and your colleagues outside of this committee need to think about as they think about corporate taxation. First of all, in terms of the general context, I think where you've ended up, and Paul's done an excellent job of introducing this, I think is a tension between building a tax system that encourages economic competitiveness for the businesses that are located in Oregon versus making sure that businesses are reimbursing or helping government pay for services that are important to them. And certainly the impetus behind some of the tax reforms of the past decade, specifically the single sales factor, was to try to give Oregon businesses the best competitive advantage that they could have as they're doing business in a global economy. Now, that said, as you look at a number of firms across the state that are paying a $10 corporate minimum, then you stop and say, well, wait a minute. At the same time, those businesses are benefiting and need a robust K-12 system, a solid higher education system, community colleges, workforce development, and good public safety in order to do business. So $10 doesn't seem to be the right answer for that. So it's that tension of trying to maintain economic competitiveness and also, I think about the benefits that businesses are receiving. So as I thought about what Paul was doing today, thinking about the specific decisions that you're going to need to move through as you think about any kind of reform or an expansion of the corporate minimum, I was thinking there are sort of at least five questions that you need to ask and answer. The first one is, how do businesses benefit from public services, and what is the best proxy for those benefits that they receive in terms of their activity? And I'll ask these questions, and I'll go back and answer them ever so briefly, or start to answer them ever so briefly. Number two is, okay, once you agree, and there will always be debate, you're not going to come to a consensus on this, on the benefits that business receive, then how much should you change the level of taxation to businesses based on those benefits? Number three is, as you think about your taxation, does your taxation or your form of taxation change the way that businesses would behave? Does it distort their behavior in some way relative to a landscape where there was no tax? That's the notion in the literature around distortion. You would prefer that businesses would behave with a tax system the same way that they would have behaved without it. You don't want them changing their behavior because of the taxes. Number four is who ultimately pays the tax. There are always debates about where the incidence of these taxes fall, and Paul and Chris have done great work with the OTIM model to try to disentangle some of that. But I think as you think about that, you need to think about who ultimately bears the tax. It's not always the person who receives the bill. And then I think the last one, which is not trivial, is how easy is it to administer, and how easy is it to keep stable in a political environment. So let me now just very quickly go back to those five questions and address them briefly. So the first one, how do businesses benefit, and what's the best proxy? You know, I think this report that Paul just put out is a great start at that. I think it's the beginning of a debate. Whether you believe 1.43 or something else really hinges on this debate around how much the education system benefits business versus private individuals. But then thinking sort of to the more important or as important topic of what is a good proxy within the business of the benefits it's receiving, let's think about a couple of the bases that you folks have been debating. Number one is corporate income, the one that you have now. The flaw with that is that implicitly assumes that only companies that are profitable benefit from public services, and we know that that's not true. So hence here you are trying to think about some minimum tax for those that are not profitable. If we go to the other end of the extreme on Paul's chart, to the gross receipts, there you've got the problem with the concerns around tax pyramiding and the purchases from other businesses. So if I'm at Echo Northwest, we have gross receipts, but we also have subcontractors from Oregon, other consultants that do things that we don't do well. Well, those consultants are paying a gross receipts tax, but then they get embedded in our work process, and we pay taxes again on them as well as our activity. So that, again, is not a wonderful proxy. So it is something probably between those two, and I think Milo is going to argue even more vigorously, something between those two is more appropriate if you're looking for a proxy of benefits. In terms of how much should you change the amount of taxation, I think, again, Paul was very helpful in getting the debate started with this document. To answer that question, you can't look in the narrow frame of corporate income taxes because that is a relatively small share of overall business taxation in the state. And so I think the advice from Ernst & Young's and others is to step back and look at the system of business taxation and compare that level across the various forms of taxation to the benefits that you argue are being received by business. On the point of does your tax change behavior and distortions, again, I'll sort of go back to the gross receipts. The main argument there is that it would create an incentive for firms to integrate. I'll just give the example of our company. We would have a tax incentive to bring in other specialists that we are currently doing subcontracts with, because if we bring them into our firm, we only have to pay the tax once, but if we use them as subcontractors, they have to pay the tax, and then we have to pay the tax on their services again. So there's this incentive for vertical integration that is certainly higher the higher the tax is. On the point of who pays the tax, and again, this is always one that's worthy of lots of debate. Put simply, the literature would suggest that that corporate taxes, if two firms are in an environment where both of the firms are paying the same tax. So if you're in the state of Oregon and you're in an industry where both of them are operating and both of them are paying the same tax, neither is at a disadvantage by passing that tax on to the consumer. So consumers for some industries where taxes are being borne and paid for by corporations in the same state are going to try to pass those to the best of their ability on to consumers. If a taxpayer is working in an environment where no other, the rest of their competitors are not paying a tax, so that would be an exporting firm, an Oregon exporter, so they're in an environment where they are selling products and other people are not having to pay that tax, the idea is that they then have to absorb that tax, and it gets pushed back and is either borne by shareholders or by labor or some party within the corporation. Then the last question, how easy or difficult is it to administer and how politically stable is a tax, I think is something that accountants and lawyers can talk about it at greater length. But clearly, as you move away from gross receipts or from corporate income and you get into things that are in the middle there is more accounting going on. There's going to be more debate around exceptions. And I think critique, while from sort of the ivory tower perspective, that the value-added taxes and taxes in the middle have better theoretical appeal, I think the argument against them is that they're very difficult to maintain politically, because people will argue for different kinds of exceptions and deductions and things of that nature, and they also become somewhat more administratively difficult to implement. So with that, I'll
okay. Well, I think, first of all, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I guess Madam Chair left, but Mr. Vice Chair, it's a privilege to be here, and I'm glad to have been asked to give you my comments. I think, given the breadth of what Paul presented at the outset, and then with John adding to it,
and just for the record, so we can keep our minutes up to date, would you state your name?
I'm sorry, Milo Ormseth.
Thank you.
I'm a retired lawyer. I was with the Stoll Reeves Law Firm for all of my legal career, but I retired in 1998, and I was a member of the advisory council to the governor's task force on revenue reform. As I say, I think I couldn't say anything if I weren't going to repeat something here, but hopefully I'll just approach it in enough of a different way so that when you listen to it this way, it may either provide some answers or provoke some questions that aren't otherwise raised. I'd like to start with three just preliminary general observations. And first relates to the argument that businesses don't pay taxes, they only collect them, and that the taxes are ultimately paid by the stakeholder persons in the business. That would be the owners or the employees or the customers. There's obviously some truth in that argument, but I think the fact is that it does make a difference who pays and who's charged with collection. In the case of a small, closely held business, there's the most truth in that statement, that what there's a direct impact on the owner or on the employees for anything that can't be passed on to the customers. And among the three groups, they will pay the whole tax and at practically the same time. When you look at a large public company, that's not quite so true anymore. The burden will have an impact on those three stakeholder groups, but since the shareholders return, particularly in a growth company that's not paying out its earnings in current dividends, the shareholders' return from the value of his stock is affected by so many other things other than the tax burden that it gets pretty dissipated in determining the ultimate return to shareholders from the business. And even in small business, there can be very important timing differences as to whether you pay the tax at the corporate level or at the individual level. Just for example, a C corporation will pay the corporate tax on its net income, currently 6%, and it'll pay that now. The shareholder in a C corp may not pay tax on that income, either with what's left after the corporate tax, for a long, long time. Maybe never, if they hold the stock until death and it gets a stepped-up basis in the estate. Whereas if it's an S corporation, there's an immediate pass-through, but the shareholder will be paying tax in Oregon at the 9% rate. So it's not true that the corporation income is not being taxed. It's just being taxed to a different person. And the timing difference and the rate difference, of course, they're significant. So overall, I think it does matter who pays. Second observation, it's really important to look at each tax as part of a whole revenue system. You take a gross receipts tax. As Paul said, the economic impact of a gross receipts tax will be very similar to a sales tax and will tend to be regressive. But the argument doesn't need to stop, or the analysis shouldn't stop at that point. In Oregon, that gross receipts tax would be part of a system in which the personal income tax is our primary source of revenue. And you can do things in the personal income tax that would alleviate the burden on the lower income people and alleviate the regressivity of the sales tax. Chief example of that would be the earned income tax credit. But there would be other ways. You could just have a credit for a certain amount of necessities. And so you can, when you view the tax as part of a whole, you can make adjustments to reduce undesirable impacts. And that, I think it's important to look at it that way. The last general observation, I think every tax has its pros and cons. It has its unintended consequences and its adverse consequences in some situations. The conclusion that I draw from that is that the best tax system would be one that uses a balanced basket of taxes at lower rates, because the burden that happens to be an unfair burden in a particular circumstance is going to be much less significant if it's at a lower rate than if that happens to be just one of just a few sources of revenue and at higher rates. And I'd just like to bring to your attention another table. Actually, it's done by the same group that prepared the report that Paul presented. This is a report that COST put out. It's published in State Tax Notes, January 21, 2008. But it shows the different rates of tax that would be required, looking at the whole national economy, to raise $50 billion from all of the states. And they chose the $50 billion figure because I think that in the years that this is based on, that was roughly what business taxes collected by all the states equaled. If you use a general gross receipts tax with no deductions, general gross receipts, traditional tax like the B&O tax in Washington, the rate necessary to raise $50 billion would be 0.28%, so less than 1%. If you use what they classify as a modified gross receipts tax, something like the Texas system as it was recently revised, or the Michigan system as it was recently revised, where you get the gross receipts minus some significant items, whether it's labor or what, that would take 0.37%. Again, still less than half of 1%. If you use a gross margin tax, which would be the gross receipts minus just the costs of goods sold, which is sort of what they were aiming for in the Texas revision that went into effect last year or the year before, it would take 0.7%, still less than 1%. When you go to a value-added tax or a VAT, a pure VAT, it would take 1.1% to collect that $50 billion. When you use business income, which they cite the Michigan income tax base as an example, they're talking about gross receipts minus labor costs, depreciation, interest, purchases from other firms, and it would require a 3.26% tax to collect $50 billion. And on a corporate net income tax, it would be 5.8%. So you see that the benefits of a broader base in the lowering of the rate that you get. Now, that's not the only consequence of the lower rate, of course, but it's an interesting table. Turning now a little bit more to specifically the topic today of a corporate minimum tax, I think first of all, when you're talking about a minimum tax, by definition, you're talking about an alternative tax. So you're talking about two or more tax bases when you're talking about a corporate minimum. And that means that the administrative and compliance burdens are doubled. Now, it may not be a true doubling because one may be easy, like say it's just a flat number, but you still have to realize that you're got two taxes to figure and two taxes to administer, and it's so you have to pay more attention to that when it's, for example, one of the ideas would be to use something like a gross receipts tax as the base for the minimum tax. Well, gross receipts are fairly easy because every business has got its sales records. But the more complex you make it, the more burdensome it becomes. Another thing I would like to say about today is focused particularly on the minimum tax. I think that this whole question has received a lot of attention, largely because of public outrage about the thought that Enron wasn't paying any corporate tax. Justifiable concern about that. But one of the things we have to focus on is why is a corporation not paying tax? And assuming that it's not filing fraudulent returns, it's because it doesn't have net income as defined by the state laws. And in the case of the Enron situation, the reason that it didn't have any income was that it lost its shirt. It's a record bankruptcy, so you really shouldn't be too surprised that a net income tax didn't yield much. And that the fact that these losses were brought into the Oregon return is a consequence of combined reporting and the requirement of combined reporting. And the state of Oregon has traditionally been one of the great advocates of combined reporting and required that. And, of course, sometimes they benefit. In my days as a tax practitioner, I was typically on the side of the business that said, no, don't combine that. And of course, the Department of Revenue was on the other side. If you've got a profitable operation outside, they'd like to find it unitary and bring it in. And then it's what goes around comes around, and it, in the case of Enron, for example, it came around. So, so much for all of that. Another thing, of course, as we look at these tax bases, we have to consider the criteria and compare the taxes in light of the criteria, and I think Paul's the sheet that he has on criteria would certainly emphasizing first of all the fairness and the different approaches to fairness. In addition to that, when you look at the system as a whole, of course, you have to look at the adequacy and stability as part of that adequacy. I think the point about neutrality that John was talking about, you want to, ideally, I think, you would have a tax system which would leave market forces free to make market decisions rather than to have those dictated by the peculiar tax consequence. Now, I say that, but obviously you have to recognize that using tax incentives have become a huge aspect of economic development and, you know, encouraging green industry and environmental considerations. And so we've taken to using tax incentives and designing taxes to achieve one thing rather than another, to not be neutral. But aside from that, you'd like to have your tax system be neutral enough so that it leaves business free to innovate and develop the things that actually work for efficiency and for the market. I guess would add one comment. There's been discussion. John particularly talked about looking at the benefits that that corporations get as a measure of the propriety of taxing them. It's not only benefits, it's burdens imposed. And we get into climate control issues, that sort of thing. And again, there are a lot of good reasons for having a tax that's not neutral, that it does incentivize good behavior. If incentivize is a word, I'm not sure that it is. Probably shouldn't be.
No.
Then focusing on the three alternatives that Paul asked us to consider, particularly the gross receipts tax, the value-added tax, and the net income tax. All three bases, of course, start with the gross revenues of a company. And for that reason, all three of those bases involve the issue of how do you apportion the income, whether you're looking at it at the gross receipts level or the net income tax level, how do you apportion it among the several states in which the company operates? And since it starts with that gross revenues, the apportionment method is relevant, equally relevant, I think, for all three. So the question of whether you're going to use a single sales factor, whether you'd go back to the original three-weighted, equally weighted three-factor formula of property, payroll, and sales, or take one of the intermediate steps, you have the same question in all three cases. Commenting specifically on the gross receipts tax, the value of it, of course, is that it's very broad-based. Because it's very broad-based, it's relatively stable as compared to net income. It's relatively simple if you just leave it as a single rate on all kinds of business. I think it's really not a good tax. John talked, and Paul too, about the pyramiding issue. To my mind, that's a sufficient reason for avoiding a gross receipts tax, because it gives so much built-in advantage to the integrated business that it really makes it difficult for the small business, which can't integrate and which has to buy its services from another business. It's just too much of an advantage for big business over small business, too much incentive to vertically integrate. Another aspect of it that you it's, you know, in a grocery store, which operates a big volume, low margin, if you impose a 1% gross receipts tax, that's a big tax. On a jewelry store that maybe operate on a 100% margin or 50%, that's what I mean there, the 1% gross receipts tax, not such a big deal. So then you start changing your rates, and then you create the problem for business and the state of administering, you know, what's something that should be taxed as a drugstore item and what's something that should be taxed as a grocery store item. When it just gets to be, when you try to make it fair, it gets a lot more complex. And it's not sensitive to the company's ability to pay, so that it's, I think it's undesirable in that, Ryan. I thought I would just quote to you something in the Oregonian from a couple days ago, talking about Governor Gregoire's proposal to revamp the B&O tax in Washington. And she says that their B&O tax is ill-conceived and harmful to small businesses, and she wants to get rid of it. And I think she's exactly right. So I'm glad to see that that they're looking at a change up there. Now, coming to what I might call a modified gross receipts tax, those of you who were on the Governor's Task Force may recall that I made a proposal to the Tax Force for what I called a modified gross receipts tax. Paul observed then correctly that my tax was really much more like a VAT. I used the term modified gross receipts, which is also an accurate description, because I thought that was a better way to describe it, but it was essentially a VAT. And the virtue of the VAT is that it does not cause pyramiding. Each business is allowed to deduct the cost of what it has paid to others, and pay tax only on the value that business has added to the product at the stage of business handled by that firm. And the VAT grew up in Europe, I think primarily to solve the problem of pyramiding that you get in the system that they'd had before, and also to make it a more fair type of sales tax impact. It is, by itself, it's regressive, so that it does have the impact of a general sales tax. And if we were to have it, we should combine it with specific programs to ameliorate the regressive effect. On the other hand, it would be more stable than the income tax, and it would be more fair than the gross receipts tax. I think probably the key difficulty in my mind with the value-added tax is that it's so little understood in this country that businesses would think, you know what, that's just too hard to figure out. How's that going to work? So it would, I think it would provoke a lot of resistance. The Well, I think really that's, I've talked enough. So I'll pass to you.
Doug? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug Henney. I'm a CPA in Portland. I manage a CPA firm in downtown Portland. I've been a tax practitioner for 30 years. I'm on the Revenue Advisory Council. I didn't have the benefit of working with the governor's task force, but I have worked on tax legislative matters, either directly with the legislature or through the Oregon Society of CPAs for many, many years. I don't have really too much prepared comments. I just want to make a few observations. I agree with the panel members and Paul and Chris. I think that it is going to be very difficult and interesting to come up with a system that is easy to administer, that's fair, works in the right situation, and raises the revenue that is necessary. So that'll be an interesting process to work through. I do have the observation that the many CPAs think that the current minimum tax is almost ludicrous. It's been $10 for decades. And every time it's proposed, we always assume it's going to go through, and it never quite gets there. So we can't quite figure that one out. So I'm not sure why it's always surprising time and time again, but you'd think I'd finally get over that.
We're hoping to make a change this
okay.
year.
Okay. And personally, I would agree. I'm not sure I have the support of all the CPAs, but yeah, it's been a strange one. So beyond that, I just want to say that we're here to help you as best we can and answer any questions today or other times as far as trying to find a system that works for everyone.
And may I say for me and the committee that we're very appreciative of the work that you and others have already done, and your availability for questions and thoughts is very much appreciated. Do we have some now? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm really looking forward to this question. Mr. Toponio is my employer, and I don't get the opportunity to grill him very often. So.
Careful.
We'll end.
Exactly.
My goodness, that's a nice tie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to test your indulgence a little bit with a number of questions that his testimony has raised in my mind. I want to return to your opening comment where you talked about that this discussion is in essence implicitly between competitiveness of our business sector and the services that we provide, and that implies that there's an equilibrium there somewhere between competitiveness and services, and so a couple of questions around trying to figure out where that equilibrium is. And in the discussion of competitiveness, there's both the idea that a business might move out of a state or that it might move into a state, whether attracting or losing a business. So I guess my question is, what makes firms locate somewhere? Is there evidence to suggest what might cause a firm to leave a state or what might cause a firm to enter and locate in a state? And do you have information on that?
Yeah. That question's not going to get you in trouble because I have an answer to it. Yes, I'd say business location, first and foremost, is where the founder grew up. So if you look at Boeing, if you look at Microsoft, Seattle had the good fortune of a couple of folks with very entrepreneurial and visionary ideas that grew up in the Seattle area. We're very fortunate in Oregon that Phil Knight ran track at the University of Oregon and had a great idea on how to use, along with Bill Bowerman, waffle irons to make shoes. So I would say, first and foremost, it's sort of the founder's entrepreneurial roots that drives where major businesses start and thrive. I would say that beyond that, the literature would suggest that taxes are a second tier issue, but are an issue. I think the first tier issue are obviously those resources that a company are going to use that are much more expensive, labor, and the availability of natural resources and access to markets and the like. And typically a firm will focus on a region that it feels it has the right mix of labor and access to natural resources in other markets. And then within that region, we'll see where within that region it has the best fit. But it is less the case that a firm is choosing between, say, a Denver and a Portland, than it is saying, okay, within the Portland metropolitan area, given that I see an advantage here, I see an access to my markets, I see the right labor mix, I see other complementary firms that are around that have the right talent base, where within this region am I going to locate? Now, taxes play a role in that, but are, I would say, second tier behind labor and those other factors that I've discussed.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. So is there a relationship then within those particular regions that might have similar first-tier considerations? Is there a relationship between geography and location and taxation? So, for example, if Washington or Idaho or California on our borders had different tax rates, would that does that affect much where the firm locates?
I would say so. I think you see the different tax structures right along the Columbia River are affecting what kind of business is operating on each side of that. Generally speaking, the Oregon tax structure is somewhat more favorable to larger publicly owned corporations, and the Washington tax structure is, because it has no income tax, more favorable to small, closely held businesses. And so consequently, you have Washington looking across with envy at big firms like Intel, and Oregon sometimes looking across at Washington and saying, why are people moving to Vancouver for the capital gains break?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
So your answer to that question and some of the testimony that we've heard today implies that the structure of the tax rate has dramatically different effects on different kinds of businesses.
Yeah, and that's a point that I wanted to make. As you think about any change to tax policy, you've had a tax policy in place for a number of years, and fees and other things, and public services, et cetera. And businesses have formed and developed to some degree, to the extent that they react to taxes, because of the tax system you have. And so if you then change it in some major way, and again, we're talking about, and generally speaking, we're talking about a corporate minimum here. That's not what I would call a major change. But if you were to change the tax system in some major way, then over some time, I would imagine there would be a transition. You would have some firms that had found the previous regime advantageous shrinking, and firms that find the newer regime advantageous growing.
You anticipated my question that so what is Oregon good at, and do we want a tax system that supports what we have now, or do we want a tax system that anticipates what we might have in the future, and how do we design a tax system to get to that?
Well, I would say that the system you have now is looking across the nation, is one that is supporting an export-based economy. Particularly with the transition to the single sales factor, you are through that tax-based giving export firms a competitive advantage relative to other states. But again, that sort of gets me back to my very first comment, which is vis-a-vis that single sales factor, you do have a number of firms that are paying the corporate minimum because of their ability to apportion away, and then you have the tension with the benefit principle. And there is, Jules, no technical answer to the right amount. I mean, this Ernst & Young has taken a first stab at a technical answer and is asserting vis-a-vis this analysis that businesses are paying more than a fair share on average. The other point I wanted to make out, though, is that you have to pay attention to the distribution around that average of 1.43 and make sure that that firms that are on the tail of that distribution that are paying very little are paying something to reimburse the state for the value they're getting out of public services, or, as Milo pointed out, the cost that they're imposing on society.
Thank you. Other questions this morning? Representative Broome.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Wonderful panel. Thank you, all three gentlemen. It was fascinating for me to listen to. I wanted to do a little bit of a tribute to Mr. Ormseth. First of all, I appreciate your testimony today, and just to some of the panel knows this. A few of the committee know this. Some do not. Mr. Ormseth was a constant and valuable presence with the Revenue Restructure Task Force that went on during the entire interim. Obviously, he demonstrated with his broad understanding of the tax base. But I just wanted to pull out one thing, Mr. Ormseth, that you said that I'd like this committee to ponder and consider as we move forward in the session, especially in regards to House Bill 2009, Mr. Chair, which is your point that given all the variables out there, a tax system to be at its maximum benefit and efficiency needs to be broad and small, not narrow and steep. Mm-hmm. And I just would throw that out there as we're thinking about House Bill 2009, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Yes.
It's okay. I wanted to go back to a point that Paul made earlier and get your take on it, and that is the arbitrary 25% of business gains from the education system, and see where you would actually place that benefit and the percentage of the cost of energy. Since that's our biggest expense in this state, who benefits from that, and what proportion does business benefit from education? And I'd like each of you to answer that if you could.
I 25% in some of these reports that you've seen, they use different ranges and simply show the impact. I don't think you'll ever get to a satisfactory answer on that. There are obviously individual benefits, very strong individual benefits and societal benefits to a well-educated workforce, and trying to parse those between the share that goes down to the individual versus corporations is difficult. I think really because that question is so difficult to answer is why you exist as a body. And
I completely agree with that. It is a political question.
And I do absolutely agree with that as well. And we struggle with that all the time. And we have some experts in front of us. And I was hoping that you could help.
Well, and so I really do believe that this is why you exist, to solve things when technicians can't. And really what it comes down to is a debate between this body and the business community, which I believe, relative to other states, you have a business community that is very engaged around the education topic, that has been a strong proponent of the 40-40-20 educational vision. So it is not lost on them that they value from it, and I think therein lies the where the debate is centered. But you're not going to find a technical answer that any majority of you would agree to.
Well, I guess make two observations. One is just pick a number, because any number you choose is going to be so arbitrary and so subject to attack, I think. Something else that perhaps is more helpful. Who benefits most depends a lot on what kind of a business you're talking about. If what you're talking about is general labor on a construction site, certainly they do benefit some from having educated people. I think everyone benefits from having an educated workforce. But the benefit of that type of business as compared with the benefit of the high-tech business and the costs that society incurs to equip somebody for just sort of, you know, general operations, it's a lot more when you're talking about the technical education that we'd like to be able to provide the industry coming in. So it's going to be a variable number.
And I think I'll need to beg off on that question, too. I think that that certainly it is, just like Milo said, it's very dependent upon the industry, not in construction, but, you know, agriculture or certain other industries. It's always important, but not as important as it would be for a professional firm, a high-tech firm, you know, some other firms like that. So it's certainly extremely valuable, but it varies.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
That's pretty much the answers I expected. But I just wanted to hear that, and I especially agree that it depends on what kind of workforce you have in your company. That's obvious. But since education is our biggest expense in this state, I think we need to figure this out to some degree.
Well, Representative Brown.
Well, and Mr. Chair, isn't it fair to say that given the change in Oregon's industrial base over the last 10, 20 years and where we see Oregon's industrial base going with green technologies, that whatever the number is, it's going to and whatever that ratio is, it's going to increase.
Yes,
I think that's
exactly.
I think that's very fair. Other questions, comments, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard from a number of the panelists that the gross receipts tax can have distortionary implications because of pyramiding of the tax. I want to just return to this idea of what distortionary means. And it implies a stickiness, I think, in a decision that persists over time. Where else might we find distortionary effects within the tax system? And what is the implication of a decision that is distortionary versus a change in an incentive?
Well, distortion, I think, in the simplest sense is having built a policy that inspires you to act differently than you would have in the absence of the policy. And so in the case of the pyramiding, I'll just give an example of our own firm. We have a number of projects where we do subcontracts with architects and planners and things of that nature that have specific expertise that Echo Northwest doesn't have. And a sizable gross receipts tax might inspire us to grow our firm and try to bring those people into Echo Northwest when, you know, generally speaking, we'd prefer to just allow them to be specialists over here, and it might be more efficient for us to operate as separate entities. But a gross receipts tax would give us an incentive then to vertically integrate, grow larger, and expand sort of our waterfront in a way that otherwise we wouldn't elect to do. There are, you know, distortions certainly in the corporate income tax as well. I mean, there's an incentive there to drive your net income or your reportable net income down to the extent that you can, so you don't have to pay taxes on it. So that could affect, as Representative Barnhart pointed out in the very beginning, different ways of sharing resources with employees, paying out net income as bonuses and things of that nature. So it's just, if the tax or the policy is changing the behavior relative to the policy not existing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I might just drill in a little bit on that answer. If distortionary is simply a change in behavior from a tax code, it would seem that every tax is distortionary by definition, because it at a minimum removes dollars that might be used for another action and opportunity cost. It might change on the margin some specific behavior on the activity that's taxed. So is there a difference between any change from a tax or something that is distortionary over a long run? And why is, say, a business activity tax more distortionary or labeled distortionary and another tax is not?
I think it is a matter of relative distortion. I mean, any tax, that is a policy, and that is going to inspire you to act differently than if the tax didn't exist. So it's really a measure of the degree of distortion between taxes, and trying to minimize those distortions would be one criteria by which you judge various taxes.
Could I chime in on that just for a minute and use a different word rather than distortionary? Discriminatory is the word I'd like to use. And just look at the discrimination between, say, an integrated manufacturer of a chair who starts with Timberland and has his own loggers and his own sawmill and produces the lumber from which the chair is made. And let's say, as Boise Cascade once did, that you've also got your distribution outlet. You can pass that chair from the tree to the retail display without ever paying a tax along the way on if you're fully integrated, that is, without having to pay a gross receipts tax. But if it's a collection of small independent businesses, there's a tax on the timber itself that's paid by the timber owner. There's a tax, let's just say that the logger buys the timber and produces the log and sells the log. When he sells the log, he's getting a price that covers both his cost of timber and his labor to log it and deliver it. So it's a double tax at that point. That is, he's paying, it's twice on the value of the raw material input, once on the logging. Okay, so he sells it to a sawmill. And when that sawmill pays its gross receipts tax on the finished lumber that it's going to supply to the chair maker, you've got a double tax on the logging cost and the timber cost, and the single cost, the single tax on the mill. And then that chair maker, when the tax is paid, well, you get the point. It accumulates as you go along, and that gives the integrated company what can amount to a very substantial burden. Just to use another example, a small business can't afford to have an in-house lawyer. I think typically where gross receipts tax, I shouldn't say typically, but I think the Washington B&O rate applicable to lawyers is 1.5%. So the company that can have an in-house lawyer has got a 1.5% saving right there, as compared with the company that has to, when it's got a transaction that it needs a lawyer for, got to go out and pay the private lawyer's fee plus 1.5% on the gross receipts because it is passed on. So you get It's the discrimination that results from the pyramiding and the ultimate increase in the burden that the consumer bears, because it will be passed on.
Thank you. Let me call.
If I could, let me give one more example.
Thank you.
Relates to the model that the City of Portland and Multnomah County has for their taxes. They disallow much of the compensation deduction, but it really only works against small firms. If you're a large local firm or particularly a large national firm, they don't have this compensation add back. They can still deduct all of their compensation. So just their particular model happens to disproportionately impact locally owned small professional firms of whatever sort. So to use his term of discriminatory, in a sense it is.
Thank you. Representative Call?
Thank you. Just two brief things. First of all, just to draw attention to Mr. Armseth earlier talked about the competing interests of simplicity and fairness in the tax code, and I just want to really draw attention to that. It's something that goes through is discussed a lot in at least the kind of legal aspects of the way we tax, and that those two things are oftentimes at great odds with each other. And I think just wanted to make sure that I drew a bit of attention to the fact that those two things are oftentimes at odds, and that's going to be important to the discussions that we have. And then just to dig a little deeper into the gross receipts tax, since we're spending a little time on it, I'd like to a couple of things that have come up for me in the examples that have been drawn, and just like to flesh these out a bit further. One of them is this idea of vertical integration, which, you know, for me automatically kind of triggers the, you know, anti-competitive bell, that there's a barrier for small businesses to come in when the vertically integrated firm is in the marketplace. And yet you said briefly before that small closely held corporations are flourishing on the other side of the river where there is a gross receipts tax and we have none here, and there seems to be a bit of cognitive dissonance there. And then also the example of the logging firm that would be incentivized to vertically integrate itself to produce the entire product within its firm. And I think logging is a really good example, because I think most of us Oregonians would love it if the log was cut, milled, produced into a product all here in Oregon. And if that was actually the result of a gross receipts tax, that while we might see vertical integration, but we might also at the same time see the result that we're seeing more things, more of these products staying in our state and being produced in our state, that might actually be a net benefit and an important trade-off with regards to the counterbalancing interest of having a more competitive marketplace. And so those are two things that just sprang to mind. And I don't know, maybe my economics is definitely not what some on this panel or in front of me or even up here on on the other side have, but want to know if I'm correct in that, and whether or not there are trade-offs here and potentially good trade-offs. So if you could answer that long rambling question, I'd be impressed. Thank you.
I think
I think you're right. There are trade-offs. In order to get the result that you are suggesting with your example, or my example of the logger, that business has to grow. The logging business is a lot different from the chair manufacturing business, and when you talk about integrated business, you're just almost unnecessarily, I think, talking about bigger business. And I don't think bigger is better. It may be sometimes, but certainly not because it's bigger.
I tend to agree,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. Could I make another comment, not in response to any particular question, but something that's okay.
Please,
yeah.
Go ahead. And then I think after that, because people have other things to do today, we're going to adjourn. And I know there are some additional questions that we haven't dealt with, and I'd ask people's indulgence to catch people on the way out in order to ask them.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The net income base does favor startups because pretty much by definition, the startups don't have any net income for a long time. And so they don't have to pay tax under that. Gross receipts tax will hit them sooner once they start to get revenues. So that you'd think that we would have a better climate for startups than Washington, and I don't know that we could show that. I mean, the facts don't seem to bear that out. But another thing that the net income tax, as opposed to a VAT or a gross receipts tax, it makes the profitable business subsidize the marginal or unprofitable business because the inefficient operator who's just getting by and not making any money doesn't pay any net income tax. But he does use up part of the market. And that's an unfortunate consequence of something that's in other aspects desirable. One final thing on when you talk about a corporate minimum tax, a lot of people say that you should make corporations pay for the privilege of non-personal liability. And there's merit in that, but that's a very variable benefit. The company that's got wide operations in a heavily risk business gets a lot of benefit from that. The company that has small operations that don't entail any unusual risk gets a minimal benefit, so that a flat charge is, whatever number you pick, it's going to be pretty arbitrary.
Thank you. And on that note, I want to again thank the panel for presentations today, and thank the committee for excellent questions, and we are adjourned.
No meeting with
See you Tuesday.